The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Before my kids go to sleep, I like to sit with them and maybe tell them stories or they tell me stories. So I was sitting with my son Nuri. At the time he was, I don't know, about 6, 7 years old. And I said, Nuri, tell me a story. So he said, I got a story. Today, my Rebbe, my teacher, said over an amazing story. He said there was this ship and it was out in the sea and it was hit by this terrible, terrible storm. Right. All of a sudden, it gets attacked by pirates. Now, my kids are Israelis, right? So I'm trying to think they get attacked by pirates. I'm thinking parrots, right? A big band of parrots, birds. I said, pirates. He says, you know what pirates are. So I'm thinking, oh yeah, pirates. Okay. So they get attacked by pirates. And the pirates come on board, and they take everything from everyone that was on board, except one man. And at this point, I'm very fascinated, lying there, you know, with my thumb in my mouth, you know, like, telling me a story. And he said, one man, the pirates couldn't take away from what he had. Right? So I said, well, who was this man? He said, Abba, he was the Jewish man. Right? I said, and why couldn't they take away from him? Well, what did he have that they couldn't take away from him? He said, Abba, now listen to this, a 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid saying this. Abba, he had Torah. He had Judaism. And that nobody can take away from me. Now, could you imagine that? When I was 6 years, 7 years, I was talking about Popeye, you know what I mean? I was talking about this. I want to talk about what can they or anyone ever take away from you. And the reason why I want to talk about this is because we're in a time of such incredible anxiety. There's so much anxiety in the world today, especially after 9/11, right? After September 11th, people were so shook up, right? I happened to notice in New York an advertisement that said, the vast majority of victims of the World Trade Center were not anywhere near the center, right? I wasn't able to read the small copy because I was actually in a taxi, so I don't know what it was referring to, but I felt it was referring to me. And I felt it was referring to everyone. That somehow what happened just a few months ago was so devastating. You know, two pillars, so to speak. Not just towers, but pillars of the symbol of stability. The pillars of what we would call in our society securities. The financial foundations of the world, as some people understand it, was gone, finished. And life feels so perishable. So perishable. And all of a sudden we realize that the only thing that we know for sure is that nothing's for sure. Nothing at all. You don't know. You're gonna one day you wake up, you have no idea. Thousands of people went to work one day, and it was an ordinary day. And what they expected was the ordinary thing, and it's just going to be another day. And it wasn't another day. It was just the beginning of a whole new period, possibly in history. So we're in tremendous, tremendous anxiety. And I can only add, living in Israel, there's a lot of anxiety. You know, you just don't know. You walk out of your door, you have no idea what your day is going to bring. Mm-hmm. I know when my children go to school, some of them don't go to school in the neighborhood, they've got to take buses. And you say goodbye to your child and you don't really know. Is this goodbye and I'll see you tonight? Or is this goodbye? You just don't know. You really don't know. You go for some pizza, right? Family outing, and you don't come back. You walk by cars, parked cars. Every car is suspicious. You know, it's one thing you think people are suspicious, but cars. A car is suspicious because it could be a car bomb. You know what I'm saying? So you start walking next to cars. I wonder why it's parked here. And you just realize, you never know. You know, when I do these trips, my family generally goes to stay with my in-laws. My in-laws, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, they live in Bet El. Bet El is a community which would be described as in what's called the territories, right? And so there's always the discussion between my wife and I, well, how should they go? Should they take the buses, which are bulletproof? But then again, terrorism is getting so more advanced that it seems like buses are a prime target. Or maybe they should take the private car, because my brother-in-law is very happy to go pick them up. But then again, there's shootings on the road. But then again, there's shootings on the road, but you can take a bus. It's bulletproof, but then again, you have to go get the bus at the central bus station. And then there's such a high risk. And you really can go with sugar, because you really think you're going to figure out where the angel of death is waiting for you. Yeah, you don't really know. So there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety. I remember when I was growing up, there was a Joni Mitchell song that says, just when you think you finally have got it made, bad news comes knocking on your gate, knocking for you. There's so much anxiety. Now, like, believe me, I listened to a lot of music growing up, but I don't remember most of the lyrics. But that lyric just touched me, because it really did say what I always thought, which is nothing's for sure, everything's perishable, everything's transient, impermanent, and you really, really don't know. I remember when I was a kid and John Lennon was shot. I don't know how many of you were around when John Lennon was shot. Right? And it was incredible. It was incredible how that night, the night he was shot, they already had a special about him. Did they know he was going to get shot? Do they actually make these specials just in case some of these famous people get shot, so they have it right away because they can be the first ones and get the commercials for it? And it's a scary thing, right? But why was I so shocked? There are people shot, there are people dying. You know, you hear this, right? But when I heard that John Lennon was shot, he was a man who for me was larger than life. You mean even larger than life dies? And the theme song for this special, you know, a tribute to John Lennon, was a song called The Dream Is Over. And remember, again, how many things do you remember in your life? But that was a shock to me, because it just hit me again. You could be the most famous, you could be larger than life, but you're going to die. And so there's a tremendous amount of anxiety that we live with all the time. The Talmud says that there were these two rabbis that made a deal. And the deal is, whichever one of us dies first comes back and tells the other one how it went. Okay? So one of them died. Okay? And they're like, waiting. Okay, we made a deal. Come on, where are you? And in fact, the guy comes to me in a dream that night. And he says, whoa, how you doing? Well, what was it like? What was death like? And he says, well, you know, death wasn't so bad. No. So no, the angel of death pulled me out of my body like hair. Like a hair being pulled out of cream. It was just smooth. You know, just smooth. He said, wow. He said, but I have to tell you something. If they decree upon me to come back, oh, I will put up a fight. Right. He said, why? He says, because it's not the death that worries me. It's the fear of death that worries me. Death happens once. And most of us will probably just die without even knowing that we were going to die. Right? Many of us will die in our sleeps. Many of us will, God, right? But it's not that moment of death, because we only die once in this life anyways. But every single day we deal with the fear of death. The fear of death is more frightening and more difficult than death itself. But the truth is, this anxiety that people are feeling today, going through, I couldn't believe it in the airport. I'm used to it in Israel. You know, they check you. But here, and they all checked me. For some reason, they all checked me. They think the redheads look most terroristic, you know what I mean? Must be, redhead. Okay. We have the profile. But they took my bags, and I don't remember this ever happening. right? They took my bags, and they went through everything. Everything. Right? And I said to the guy, he was very sweet, and I was fine with it, and he was, I'm sorry, I have to do this. And he's going, I said, that's my dirty laundry. Okay, he's putting his hands in there. I'm fine, listen, that's just a job, anything you want to do. Right? So I said, listen, sir, I'm used to this, don't worry, I'm from Israel. He says, oh yeah, I said, but in Israel, we have machines that do this. Right? He says, oh yeah, I know, there's this room back there, we've been promised we're going to get this big x-ray machine, but it hasn't come yet, so this is where we got to do it. Right? It's really quite amazing. As one's going through customs, and this one customs man was so mean to me. He's asking me so many questions, right? So he says, okay, you can go along, sir. So I say, oh, okay, thank you. So I'm walking by. I say, wait a second, come back here, you young man. I say, yes, sir. Right? These guys are very serious because they've got a very important job, you know, and so they take it very serious, and that's good. He says, what are those strings hanging out of your pants? I say, what else? What, excuse me? Says the strings hanging out of your pants. What are those? Right now, I felt harassed enough. And I was feeling like, okay, I've had it. And was about to go like this. Step back and I'll pull them. Okay? Right now, I'll pull them right now. So I was about to do that. I was just kind of reaching for it. But I thought, you know, I really have to get on the plane. I don't want to be in jail. So I want to land, but not in jail. Okay? So I was about to do that. I said, no, I won't do that. Okay, I won't do that. So I told him, he says, what? I said, well, what are you supposed to say to, you know, he didn't look Jewish. Okay, and even if he was Jewish, he wouldn't know what it is. So I said to him, I looked him in the face and I said, they're titties. Right? So he's staring at me and I could see he's going in his head, you know, like in this, his customs manual, titsis, 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 titsis. he doesn't know anything about this. They didn't teach him about titsis, right? But, so there's that moment of hesitation, and finally looks at me and says, what are titsis? Right? I said, they remind me of my ever-present connection to God. He says, well, I understood that very well, and thank you very much. You have a nice day, sir. There's anxiety. People are nervous. Someone might pull their titties. You gotta watch out for the guys with the strings, right? Truth is, if you pull them, we go, mama. Right? So, it's very harmless, these little strings that we pull. Anyways, you know, some people pull some strings. We can pull some strings in this world. But the truth is, this anxiety isn't new at all. Poverty, death, disease, right? Suffering. This isn't new. This started in the Garden of Eden, right? This has been going for a long time. So why are there periods where there seems to be more anxiety and periods where there seems to be less anxiety? And the truth is that it's never changed. We've always been under threat, right? But we succeed in our society to distract ourselves from all the anxiety. So much of culture is precisely how to escape the pain, the fear, and the anxiety. So much of it. You know, I grew up, my mother is a Holocaust survivor, so I was very, very aware of the suffering the Jewish people went through and the terrible suffering that could happen to anybody. And so I grew up really quite conscious of the transience of life. And it was something that really, really, really bothered me. And there were nights where I had a hard time going to sleep. So how would I get myself to sleep? I had this incredible stereo, right, with these two speakers, one on each side of my bed, right? And I would go to sleep with hard rock and roll, right? That's how I would go to sleep, because otherwise I would just think about all the horrible I would worry about, right? So it's just like, you know, I would just put those two speakers. And so much I realized of my life was running away from facing the anxiety and the transience of my life. And that's really society. It's amusement. So much of amusement is to amuse us, right? To put us to sleep. It's kind of like a dope, right? There's different kinds of dope, but we want to dope people down. Because the more sensitive you are, the more attuned you are to life, then the greater chances of the anxiety realizing how much life is not stable and how you can't really trust or rely on anything because you just never really know. So much of it is in fact running away. I remember one rock album, you probably won't remember this guy, his name was Edgar Winters. And so on the bottom of, I'm not so old, okay. So on the bottom of his album, it said, "For best results, play at full blast." That was true, right? You know, because that's the best results, you just turn it up, right? You know, give me your Beat Boys and Free My Soul, want to get off on your rock and roll, drift away. That was so much of my life, and that's so much of most people's life, which is that we really are looking for ways to run away. You know, when I'm in the United States and it's late and I can't fall asleep, turn on the television, there's comedy channels. I love comedy. You know, I love to laugh. I love to help people laugh. Mm-hmm. But, and so much of this comedy I find not funny at all. Have you ever turned it on and you're like, everyone's cracking up, or they take you into like these cafes, these comedy bars, and like, the guy gets up, and everyone's rolling, they're cracking, you know, they've got the camera shoots the audience, and people, you know, I'm trying to think, something wrong with me? I didn't think that was funny. Did I miss the joke? And I kind of think that people come saying, we are going to laugh, and by golly, we are going to laugh no matter what this idiot says. It doesn't matter. We have to laugh. So the question I want to ask is this, and this is really, again, not a new question. It was a question dealt with by Kohelis. King Solomon wrote an amazing book called Ecclesiastes. Potentially, if you don't understand it, it is the most depressing book you will ever read in your life. Right? Because it takes you through exactly what everybody tries to do to deal with the anxiety of Hevel Havali Mokol Hevel. Futile of futilities, all is futile. Hevel is vapor. Hevel means vain. Hevel means futile. But hevel also means vapor. Like on a cold day, not like today, on a cold day, you know, we're in Orlando, so, you know, go like this, and there's your breath, and it looks like it's something, but it's really nothing. And that's exactly what King Solomon is struggling with in his book of Kohelis. Everything looks so permanent, everything looks so solid, but you know it really isn't. Everything seems to be going around in circles. The sun rises only to set, to rise only to set, and there's nothing new under the sun. Everything seems to really not last. And so if you really study Kohelis, Ecclesiastes, in depth, he goes through all the various ways people try to deal with, or to be actually more correct, run away from dealing with, go into denial of this fabulous pain, right? Of the fact that nothing's for sure. Nothing's for sure. So the question I want to address is this. Can we be happy in a life that's so full of anxiety? Can we be happy in a life that really is insecure? Because generally people feel that we can be happy as long as there's some good time awaiting us. Right? So if it's not good now, but at least it's going to get better. Right? As long as we feel that there's something on its way, fine. But does happiness depend upon the promise of a good future? What if you're not going to have a good future? What if you know in 2 months from now, God forbid, you're going to die? So for the next 2 months, you're going to be miserable? Right? Because, you know, but what, is it just a matter of time? The Midrash says when a baby's born, we rejoice, but don't you know he's going to die eventually? Right? So what's there to rejoice? Right? Well, people say, well, forget about that. Right. So I want to live forever, don't want to die. Yeah, we won't die. We'll forget about that. But the truth is the moment now meaningful, beautiful, and joyful only if the next moment promises me that? Or if the pain of this moment is so great, can I still deal with it if I didn't think that there would be the next moment will be better? Do I need a promise of a good future? So many people live their lives for their vacation, right? Like right now, you know, like I hate my job, and I don't like the people I'm hanging out with, but I know that, you know, Israelite winter retreat is coming, you know, in the next 6 months, and I will get through, because when then I'll be happy. That's true, right? It's true. But it's only 5 days. And then what happens? You get the new retreat, right? And you can live from retreat to retreat. Okay. And then you've got the Labor Day retreat, right? But the truth is, can we be happy now if the future is so insecure? So there are different solutions to this problem. Some people's attitude is, you know what? There's really no guarantees. Remember my wife, she was at the funeral of her cousin. Her cousin was a young woman, died of cancer. And my wife was there at the funeral as they were burying her cousin. And her, my wife's cousin, a fellow who was alive, he was also. And as they are lowering the coffin into the grave, he just nods his head back and forth and says, "That's it. That's what life is. From dust to dust. You just got to seize the moment. Get what you can. Live it up now." Right? That was his attitude. And that's most people's attitude. Most people's attitude is live it up now. It's not a new attitude. It was a Roman attitude. It's called eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow, we will die. And since we know tomorrow we will die, if the moment presents itself, live it up. Live for the moment. Sacrifice the future, because you don't know how good that future will be. It's likely it won't be so good. You don't know. All you know is the now. And only the now is guaranteed you. And therefore, seize the moment. Live it up. Grab what you can. While you can, cram it all in right now. To quote another great prophet, come and get it. Because it's going fast. Fast going. Because it may not last. Because that's it. If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. But that's the way it is. And that's the way many people live their lives. They live for the moment. There's another attitude. The other attitude is, I'm not going to live for the moment. Okay? That's silly. Right? I'm going to forfeit the moment for the future. Right? I'm going to give up the joys and the excitement, the sensual pleasures of this world, for the promise of the great next world. I will surrender the moment for an everlasting, beautiful future. The question is, which one of these approaches is Jewish? Is it seize the moment, live it up now, and forget about the future? Or is it surrender the moment, suffer the moment, but it's okay, because there's a promise of Mashiach coming. There's a promise of Olam Haba, the world to come. Right? And therefore, suffer now and enjoy later. Which one of these approaches is genuinely Jewish? Well, actually, it's the first one, but with a modification. It's actually seize the moment. And I'll tell you why. Interestingly enough, Judaism really is about live the moment. Live the moment, but cram into it everlasting meaning. But in the moment. In the moment. How do I know that? Because it's so interesting. If you look in the five books of Moses, the Chumash, strange, there is absolutely no mention of a world to come. Right? Many of you perhaps have heard in Judaism, Judaism talks about the world to come. Right? Well, it's so strange that the entire five books of Moses, the Chumash, mention nothing about the world to come. Nothing at all. Right? Now, our sages, I'm not saying it's not a true phenomena that there is a world to come, but why would the Torah, the five books of Moses, not mention anything about some promise of a future world? Okay, it also doesn't specifically, directly mention Mashiach. Right? We have the mention of Mashiach in the prophets later on, but in the five books of Moses, there is absolutely no mention, maybe hints, you know, if you look in retrospect, you might say, oh, it was hinted, but without that, no, there was no direct mention of for sure Mashiach, a Mashiach, a Messiah coming, and there's some wonderful messianic age. In addition to that, I have to tell you that even in our tradition that talks about Mashiach, right, it doesn't paint this incredibly beautiful picture. The Talmud says that the difference between the time of Mashiach and any other time is the sovereignty of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. You have to understand that. According to the Talmud, if the only distinction between the times of Messiah, the Messianic times, and any other time, is the sovereignty over the land of Israel, then you have to know that we are in the Messianic age. This is the Messianic age that they were talking about. Because we have sovereignty over the land of Israel. Right? It's an amazing thing. The Talmud says that when the land begins to give its fruits, that is no sure sign that this is the age of Mashiach. And the land of Israel is giving its fruits. And if you go to, you know, Machane Yehuda, right, in Jerusalem, right, and you look at the fruits of the land, right, I mean, you taste the land. It's unbelievable. You go to deserts. The Jewish people went to the land of Israel and took deserts and they turned it into paradise. It's unbelievable. This is the Messianic age. Yeah. Well, why is there so much anxiety? It doesn't say that there won't be poverty. It doesn't say that there won't be disease. It doesn't say it won't be death. Right? There's simply the sovereignty of the Jewish people over the land of Israel. This is the times of Mashiach. Right? So where's the promise of this wonderful, great future? Doesn't seem to have a promise. When you look in the Shema, what are the rewards for doing mitzvot, for performing the commandments? Right? It says, and if you follow my commandments, there will be grass in your fields for your cows. That's what I get for my mitzvahs? That's what I get? I mean, I have been holding back my whole life not to eat a 99-cent McDonald's cheeseburger. I mean, I haven't been eating these cows, right? And in my reward for that, they will be eating grass? I don't get it. That's my reward. Right? And then it says, and there'll be rain in its time. Okay, that's nice, you know? There'll be rain in its time. And I will go out into my field, and I will be able to harvest my field. Which means I will be able to work hard. That's what I get for doing my mitzvahs. Right? That I will be able to work hard and reap my harvest. That's what it says. No promise of some incredible, awesome, amazing world to come. You know, amongst Muslim fundamentalists, what they tell these terrorists, if you blow yourself up, right, and kill a lot of Jews, right, you get the world to come. And what is the world to come? It is the fantasies of this world, right? They tell the men that you will have a harem. You will have these incredible cars. You will have, this is what they're told. And since some of them are in terrible, terrible poverty, feeling terrible, terrible despair, right? So the power of faith and the power of brainwashing, and they promise you a future, this everlasting, awesome world. And they do it, right? They do it. But in Jewish tradition, we don't do it for the future. We don't live the now for some wonderful future. It says in Pirkei Avot, don't serve the Great One, referring to Hashem, in order to get a prize. Right? You should serve the Great One in order not to get a prize. You do it because that's what you do and there's absolutely no guarantee. I want you to understand, this is very difficult for people who are possibly entertaining, you know, embracing a little bit of Jewish life. Because they're hoping that if they do this, all of life is now going to be better. Right? All of life is now going to be better. I remember a woman who was at one of the recent retreats, and she said to me that she so much wants to meet her soulmate. Right? Rabbi, do you think if I start keeping Shabbos, Hashem will give me my soulmate? Right? Because I have friends who keep Shabbos and they became Balei Tshuva and they met guys, right? Right. So if I kept Shabbos, is that why Hashem isn't bringing me a guy? I said, what are you talking about? A lot of people who are wonderful, incredible, you know, Jews do mitzvahs their whole life and they're still struggling and hoping to find their soulmate, right? You can't do it for that reason. And that's the sad thing, because people think that if I start living the Torah lifestyle, that will promise me a good future. And all the pain that I'm feeling right now, the way I can deal with that is by, in fact, embracing Judaism, which will promise me this great future. But it doesn't work that way. Sometimes it works just the opposite. Sometimes just as you embrace it, you know, you're given even more challenges. He said, oh, that doesn't make any sense. I remember when I was studying with this actor, Kirk Douglas, and we were learning Torah, and he was getting very excited, and he was evolving, and he decided that he would light Shabbat candles, you know. He decided that he wouldn't eat pig anymore. These were very big moves for him, right? But then, in the middle of all that, he had a stroke. Here he was, returning to God, returning to Judaism, and he has a stroke. How could you do this to me, God? No promise. Hashem makes no promise. Certainly not in the immediate future, that necessarily because you'll do this, life will be smooth and the events of your life will not be challenging. It doesn't say that. In fact, there's a cute little story about the Baal Shem Tov. It says that the Baal Shem Tov one day did something wrong. And a divine voice came out and said, "Holy Baal Shem Tov, you have just lost your portion in the world to come." And what was the reaction of the Baal Shem Tov? He rejoiced. He was so happy, right? One of his friends sees the Baal Shem Tov go to the street. He's so excited, so happy. He says, "What's going on? I just lost my portion of the world to come." Right? I said, "Why are you so happy?" He says, "Because now I know that whatever I do is purely just for God. Right? And not for some future benefit." Right? And when the Baal Shem Tov came to that realization, he was given his will to come. He went into therapy for the rest of his life. No, I'm just joking. You see, people think that Judaism is about the world to come, the messianic age. If I do this now, it's worth it, even though it's not fun, even though it's annoying, it's challenging, it's upsetting, I can't eat whatever I want to, I can't marry whoever I want to, I can't do whatever I feel like doing, but I'm willing to suffer the now because I'm afraid that if I don't suffer the now, I will lose the everlasting future of these great pleasures, right? But that is not the truth of Yiddishkeit, of Jewish tradition. Because Jewish tradition actually believes you have to live the moment and live it up. The Jewish tradition says, yes, we want you to live it up, but if you really want to live it up, if you really want to seize the moment, and you want to fully live the moment, you think eating pizza fully lives the moment? You think wiggling around in a discotheque as fast as your little parts of your bodies and tubes can move, that's living it up? Is that what living it up is? Yeah. I remember I used to go to these rock concerts. The music was so loud that the policemen up front that were kind of guarding that nobody gets on stage, they used to put bullets in their ears. Right? Bullets in their ears. It was so loud. It was so crazy. So the question really is, just what's it mean to live it up? Right? Judaism says, yeah, live it up. Seize the moment. Live for the now. Right? But how does one truly live for the now? How do I make this now the most incredible, beautiful, powerful, meaningful moment? Because that's really all we have, is this moment. So what are we going to do with it? What are we going to do with it? You know, there's an interesting law in Jewish tradition that if you support a person in their learning of Torah, right, then you get a portion of their world to come. Right? Right? So, I could be a wealthy guy. I don't feel like learning Torah. So, I support some guy who learned Torah. So, Philip went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Avraha, who was one of our greatest sages. And he says to me, "No, Rebbe, I'm a wealthy guy. I do well in business. I enjoy business. And I could support people learning. Right? So why shouldn't I do that? I could support people learning, and I could get the world to come. Olam haba. So the rabbi said, it's true. Right? It's true, but let me ask you something. Right? What will you do for your olam hazeh? What will you do for your this world? In other words, he thought, you learn Torah, and you're willing to sacrifice the joys of this world because of some promise for some next world. But Moshe Feinstein said, no, it's not that way. It's not that way. What are you going to do for this world? We learn Torah not because it's preparing us for the next world. We learn Torah not because it's going to make tomorrow better. We learn Torah not for the future, but we learn Torah for the present. And that is something that people really don't understand. In other words, Jewish life is not a promise for a better future. It promises a better presence. A much better presence. And that's the difference between living your life in fear or living your life in love. Fear is about the future. I do something because I'm afraid of what might happen. Right? What I might lose or what I could have gained, that's fear. But love is the now. When you do something out of love, you do it because now you love. If I do a mitzvah now, it's because now I love Hashem. And my ability to do that mitzvah is an opportunity to experience that, an opportunity to manifest that, communicate that to myself. But it has nothing to do with the future. Nothing to do with the future. And so, in Jewish tradition, we are taught, don't rip yourself off. Seize the moment. Live it up now. Don't waste your moment on lusts that don't last. Don't become, as one Jewish philosopher calls it, an undertaker for desires. The worst thing that you could ever do is get your desires, because as soon as you get them, they're gone. Right? The anticipation for those desires are more pleasurable when you finally get them, because it's like that, they're gone. Right? So then how does, and this is the question of Judaism, how does one truly live up the moment, rather than being anxious about the future? Which is exactly why people can't live and enjoy the moment, because they're so afraid of what's going to be in the future. Right now everything's fine, but I know in a month from now I have to go through some surgery. So I'll be a nervous, horrible wreck, right? And absolutely feel horrible for the next month. But why? Right now, you've got good friends. Right now, things are okay. So, like, when it gets there, you'll deal with it. But right now, but the anxiety of what will be is undermining what is. And our lives is only what is. And therefore, the Jewish approach is called serve God now. What does it mean to serve God now? It means in this moment, be a vessel to bring meaning and true substance into this moment. Everlasting meaning into the moment. This, by the way, was the difference between a man named Esav and his brother Jacob. Right? Esav lived for the moment. If you know the story, he comes in, he's been hunting, he sees his brother Yaakov cooking up this red pottage thing, and he says, what's that red stuff, brother? Pour it down my throat, I'm gonna die. So Yaakov says to him, hey bro, I'll give it to you, but you'll sell me your birthright, okay? Right? Now you don't have to sell birthright, you can go for free, okay? For 10 days, okay? So he says, sell me your birthright. So, it says that Esau sold his birthright to Yaakov for a bunch of beans. Okay, for a bunch of beans. But the Midrash, the oral tradition, fills in the dialogue. And this is the dialogue. Esau says to Yaakov, I don't get it. Why do you want the birthright? Why is it so important to be the firstborn? So Yaakov says, because the firstborn is going to have the opportunity to serve in the temple, in the holy temple. Right? So Esau says, so what's the big deal? You know, what's the big deal? So Yaakov says, well, I'll tell you a little bit about the temple. If you go there and your hair is all crazy, you know, it's not really like really fixed really nicely, right? So you are punishable by death. Asa was the hairiest guy around, right? He was so hairy, his body was so hairy, it looked like he was wearing a fur coat, right? And it was when he was born yet, okay? He looked more like a monkey than a man, okay? So Asa says, yeah? He says, yeah, and if you go in there and you have like a couple of drinks before you go in there, punish him by death. Oh, really? Right? And basically, Yaakov starts telling Esau the laws, right? The stringent laws that a Kohen has to abide by when and before he does his service. Or punishable by law, by death. Right? So Esau says, oh, man, I don't want this. I'm going to die. That's why when he says to him, give me that red stuff, right? And he says, well, I will, but if you give me the birthright, he says, well, I'm going to die. So then he says, what do you mean I'm going to die? Well, why was he going to die? He wasn't so hungry. He hadn't eaten in a day. You don't die, right? So he was really saying, I'm going to die anyways, right? Now listen to this. But what is this all about? When you look in the Torah, and you read the Torah, there's all these laws that if you do this, but if you don't do this, punishable by death. Punishable by, for Shabbat. The laws of Shabbat. Right? Punishable by death. Right? Punishable by death. It's an amazing thing. One of the punishments for breaking the Shabbat is they would stone you. They would stone you. I know some guys that used to go to camp and on Shabbat, right? They would light a match intentionally at Shabbat and say, we are now obligated to be stoned. And that's what they would do. They'd use the match and get stoned. Okay? Okay? Yeah, listen, anything for God, right? You gotta get stoned. They're stoning you, man. Okay. Everybody's gotta get stoned. Okay. So what was Yaakov saying? What was he saying? Why would I want a Torah? Everybody knows that the Torah is called the Eitz Chaim Hi, the tree of life. But if you look in the Torah, if you do this, you get death. If you do this, you get death. The interesting thing is that technically, it's almost impossible to get the death penalty in Judaism. Almost impossible. Because the rulings of the court and the details and the necessities of what it takes to come to such a judgment are so exact that the chances of ever a death penalty being passed is almost impossible. The Talmud says if a court punishes somebody by death once in 40 years, it's considered to be a deathly murderous court. Another opinion says no. If a Jewish court punishes someone by death once in 400 years, right, then that would be a murderous court. That's how almost absolutely impossible it is to ever actually get death penalty in Judaism. So if that's true, why is it the death penalty still mentioned in the Torah? So I heard Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach, Zichron Avracha, once give an incredible answer. He said the Torah talks about the death penalty to tell you how much life is in it if you keep it. Right? The Shabbat is punishable by death, but you're never really going to get death penalty. But it's in the most dramatic way the Torah wants to teach us. You realize if something as small as that theoretically is punishable by death, imagine how much life is in it. And that's what Yaakov understood. Esau said, if I live this, do this, I'm going to be even more an anxious mess. Esau believed in eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. And Yaakov says, no, eat, drink, and be merry, but do it with the consciousness of God. And seize the moment. We both agree, seize the moment. We both agree, live up the moment. But what is the real way? How does one live up the moment? How do I infuse this moment with the greatest amount of life force? It's by using this moment in service of the life source. That's how I infuse it with the life force. Living it fully. And that's really the goal of Jewish tradition. So how does a person overcome the anxiety of this world that we live in? It's to embrace the moment now. Immerse yourself in the moment. This is the teaching and the lesson of one of the most beautiful holidays of the Jewish calendar, which is called Sukkot. Okay? Sukkot is called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy. Okay? Now, what happens on Sukkot?
We have something called the four minim, the four species. Okay? And you maybe have seen that before. You've got something called the lulav, right? Which is a palm branch, which is something called an etrog, which is, I don't know what they call those in English, citrons or something. That's citrons, that's a cargo, isn't it? Okay. Some people rather have a citron than an etrog. Right? You have an etrog, then you have the hadas, right? You have the aravot, right? And what's so amazing is right after Yom Kippur, the most intense time, right? The next day, especially in Yerushalayim, you gotta come. It's awesome. You go out and you see people looking at these lemons, right? The etrogs. Yeah, you see these vintage-looking Jews with these little gem glasses, right? Looking at an etrog to see if it has a little blemish. Because especially on Sukkot, we have this consciousness called Mahadrin. We want to do the mitzvah, but in the most beautiful, beautiful way. And people could spend hundreds of dollars on these four minim, right? But that seems to be ridiculous, because you know in a week from now, they'll be worth nothing. That etrog that cost you 1 week ago, maybe $100, again you can get cheaper ones, right? But some people invest maybe $120 on an etrog, in 1 week from now, will be worth less than a lemon. Right? This is amazing. And what happens during Sukkot? You watch these incredible, beautiful meme that you spend so much money on, you watch them wilt away. Right? And you just shake them up. But they're really dead. Why not, you know, in a world that we're in with such advanced technology, why can't we create, right, a nice looking plastic, you know, etrog? Wouldn't that be good enough? And we could have it for every year? Right? I mean, nowadays they've got these artificial flowers that, mamish, you go up to them and they even smell nice. Right? They even have, you know, the sounds of a bee coming out of it. I don't know. They have everything, right? It's like, wow. This, you know, but it's so amazing. It looks so real. Have you ever gone up to some of these plants in some of these airports and things, you really got to get close sometimes to see, is this real or not? Right? Well, that makes sense because it'll last. But Sukkot, we immerse ourselves in this flimsy hut, this temporary dwelling, and we embrace these meaning, these species that are perishable. And what do? With these meaning, we shake them up into the four corners, which really seems kind of silly. We just end up in the same place we started. And then we walk around the bima, and we go in circles. Right? Do you know what book we read during this holiday? Kohelis, Ecclesiastes. The most depressing book in all the scriptures are read on Zman Simchatenu, in the times of our joy. Why? And you know what they say in Kabbalah? You're supposed to be in the shadow, the shade of the schach, of the sukkah, of the hut. It calls that shade the shade of faith, the shadow of faith. That's faith, that's trust. Right? That feels like the shadow of doubt. Right? Who knows if this thing's going to last? Why do we read Kohelis and Sukkos? Because in Jewish tradition, the key to happiness and the key to serenity is to immerse yourself and to embrace the transience and know that all you have is now. Right? Morty said, all I have is 5 minutes. But all I have is now. Okay? And now, and now, and now. That's all we have, is now. When we embrace the now, as transient as it is, and we live up the now, and we live for the now, but we realize that the now is a presentation, so to speak. The present is really God, so to speak, making himself present right now. And when I merge with this moment and fully live up this moment, then I'm happy. And that's all I have to do. Therefore, the final conclusion of Kohelis, after he goes through all the great escapes, running away from the transience of life, he finally says, you know what? There's only one thing to do. And that, Judaism would say, is mitzvah. Live in the now, serve God now, connect to God now,
Ah, does that mean the future is not important? The past is not important? We'll talk about that later on this afternoon. But for now, just for now, it's important to understand that Judaism does not live in the future. And I don't live my now because I think there'll be some promise of some better future, and that therefore I can suffer the now. No. In Jewish tradition, we completely immerse ourselves in the moment. We completely give ourselves over to the moment. We seize the moment. It's about living it up now. But now the question is, how does one truly live up the moment? How does one fully live? In Jewish tradition, to fully live the moment would mean to fully serve the source of every moment. To fully serve the source of life fills me with the force of life right now. And what will happen tomorrow is not the point. It's what will happen now and now and now. And now I'm finished.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.